Welcome, everybody, to the Stoke It Up podcast, a podcast encouraging you in your journey with God. I'm Alan Stoddard, and I'm your host, and today we're discussing spiritual formation and its relationship to disciple-making. Now, that sounds like a mouthful, but when I think of that important, beefy topic, the name that comes to my mind is Daryl Eldridge for many reasons. Dr. Eldridge lives with his wife, Carol, in Galveston, Texas. Daryl's the former Dean of Educational Ministries at Southwestern in Fort Worth. And in 2002, and I have questions about this, founded the first fully online seminary, Rockbridge Seminary, which we will put the web address for the seminary in the show notes. Daryl, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for coming on, man. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Alan. Looking forward to this important conversation.
Well, spiritual formation versus disciple making. I wanted to pick your brain about it. I think it's a need out there with all of the hype, good hype, I think, about disciple making these days. But what is spiritual formation, Daryl? What makes the topic so important? Like at Rockbridge Seminary, there are certain spiritual practices that are built in to each course as a part of the academic DNA. What's your thinking of that?
Well, you know, every seminary has talked about the importance of the head, heart, and hands. And so what we've discovered is that we spend a lot more on the head and on the hands and not enough on the heart. And of course, spiritual formation has been defined, and we could discuss that in an academic sense some other time, but as one's deepening one's relationship with God. So you would think that at a seminary, the thing that should happen more than anything else, that my relationship with God is deepened. And yet so many seminarians say when they left seminary, they were less close to God than they were when they entered, which is a whole nother kind of examination of why that takes place. But, you know, you can get real dry when you're sometimes in seminary, and yet your head is being filled with all kinds of theological understandings and cognition that it can dry up one, quote, spiritually. Yeah. So we try to address that by saying, how do we make that an integral part, a thread of all of our curriculum, as you've just discussed?
Yeah. When I remember as a student at Southwestern, right when I was transitioning to graduate, they started doing these spiritual formation 1 hour things. Yeah. That may have been something that was already going on for a year, but I don't think I had to do it because I was in a different. Were you a part of that thinking there?
Yeah. We had a committee that looked at seminary education in the 21st century. And one of the things that we began feeling like is, how do we, again, bring it all three schools in that seminary? They had different schools together and doing spiritual formation so that we, you know, we had pastors in training and ministers of education in training, musicians in training. How do we bring them all together in a set and in one group to get to know one another and to work on our inner life? And so we developed that kind of process. The other thing we found out is that, like, one of my pastors I work with, when I asked him about small groups, he had never, ever been in a small group, never. And so when we were studying the purpose-driven life, he said, you know, I've never done this. I've never done a small group. I said, so I'll be glad to lead that thing, and you'll just be a part of it. And so that says, you know, we've got to have some small group experiences. If the church is growing through small groups, that's part of your discipleship, a huge part of your discipleship efforts, then it seems to me that everyone that's going to be a minister should be involved in a small group. So that spiritual formation was being done in the context of a small group.
Now, you gave a statistic back in the day, 20 years ago, that was, I think it was 90% of pastors are not in a small group.
Yep.
And I remember I said that to Haddon Robinson. Yep. And he had me hit you back. I don't know if you remember that. But he said, you got to footnote that. And I said, well, I'll ask him where he got it. I hit you up and you said, you've been asking pastors in kind of informally, organically for years. And I told him that. He said, okay, I get that. Just write that in the text note, blah, blah, blah. But then I asked you, I think, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago, that's about that same number. And you said it had gotten better. What do you think the status is now?
Maybe gotten worse. And the pandemic certainly has impacted that, but I don't see that number has changed much at all. And I think there's some groups and networks that may do better than that than others, but I think that probably still about 90% have never been a part of small group, are not in a small group. Yeah.
Since we're near the topic, what are you thinking and what have you observed about small group life online since the pandemic? Valuable, not valuable?
Well, sure, it's valuable. And I you'd rather have that than have nothing, right? So it's not a question of, well, let's not do anything. So I think it's been a good substitute for it. But there's still this relational component that there's a slight one-off, I think, when you're on Zoom as opposed to when you're face-to-face and you can touch people, you see people, you gather the atmosphere that everything's taking place and you understand context that way, which is just still tough, I think, with Zoom. So it's not like, it's like a lot of online things. It's not like stores are going to stop doing online, but they're going to do both. And but the preference would always be, I think, to come in the store, try on the product or try out the product, talk to someone who knows the product. And you can, there's just a whole different flavor than pushing a button, have it come to your house and, you try it on, you send it back. I think it was a great way for us to reach people that we might not have reached and be a part of continued discipleship process going on. It was a good move.
So do you think it's a bigger part online community, bigger part now in local churches than it was before the pandemic, a bigger need?
Well, I don't know if it's a bigger need, but I think it's more, it's more utilized now than it was before, and it's not going to go away. And for some people that, who can't get there at 1 hour, it gives you opportunity to really expand your opportunities for discipleship as well. But
I've been doing an online Bible study for 3 years since the pandemic. Crazy. And I'm, it's not one where I'm overly preparing and things like that. I'm just walking people through chapters and books of the Bible best I can. Sometimes I'm way out of my league on some of the books of the Bible. But what I've noticed after 3 years is that group, about 30 to 50 people that circle through there, they've become a little online community. And that the kicker is every day. It's happened so often, and I'm hitting them at a sweet spot. They're going, I'm going to chime in on this. I'm going to get in. And it's been a picture to me that that needs to be painted of, we ought to, in the church, not regress all the way back to where we were before the pandemic. I think a lot of ministries have done that. That's probably a separate conversation. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. What is the difference in your experience between spiritual formation and disciple making?
Yeah. So it's a great academic question, and Dallas Willard could do a better job of interpreting that. But for me, spiritual formation has to do with one's relationship with God. Discipleship, particularly in the Western culture, has boiled down to focusing on one's faith and practice within a context of a certain faith community. So I think that's, you can parse that all you want to, but I can't see discipleship without spiritual formation. And I And I certainly wouldn't want spiritual formation can take place, and that's good, but it also has to, you know, you have to do something with that in terms of how you apply that and use it and so forth, and it requires other knowledge. So I don't know that we can separate those two, but what I think we have seen is that discipleship in the Western culture has become more focused on knowledge, cognition, head stuff, rather than the heart, rather than the being, rather than working on my inner core, my what a world, secular world would say, my spirituality. Who am I? So here again, you know, we can make that an academic exercise, but I want, you know, I want people to both be spiritually formed, that's the work of the Spirit, but it's also in context with working with other people. I don't know that spiritual formation can take place without others, but I certainly think it's facilitated, and God uses other people in my spiritual formation as well as in my discipleship.
Do you think too much organization and strategy can work against spiritual formation?
I do. And, you know, if when we look at Jesus, what was his strategy, right? What did he do? I don't see in reading the New Testament that he had a set curriculum he was working through, you know, 1 through 10. And oh my goodness, you know, we're only on book 3 now, and it should be further along by now. and he didn't seem to have even a set of core of beliefs, you know, that he didn't expect his followers to say, okay, you've got to believe these things before you sign up, or he didn't ask them to change their ways. They just decided they're going to live together, and they walked together, and they ate together, and they, you know, it was discipleship by really by being, well, we say this phrase, Christianity is caught more than it is taught. And I think living with people really where the rubber hits the road. And so when you're in a small group, or even a group of one, or, you know, another person to three, a very small group, things come up in our daily life that we have to deal with. And it is in that context, I think, that real discipleship is born. I had a past, I learned how to do, you know, how to visit in the hospital with members by going with one of my early pastors and in my ministry. And I said, you know, I really thank you for discipling about that. We never sat down and talked about hospital visitation. I just observed him and saw what he did and how he did it. And it became part of my, you know, I thought through that, you know, what that all meant. And of course, but I caught it, you know, it was something that I did because I was walking with him. I was journeying with him. I was, discipleship was a way of life, not a bunch of things that you have to memorize and understand.
I love that. We talked the other day when I was in Galveston, and you mentioned that our church cultures are asking this, who is God kind of questions. And then you said, there's a better question we should be asking. What is that question, and why the difference?
Well, I don't know if it's a better question, but it is a question that we need to ask. And the question with who is God is, really? You think you can figure that out? Yeah, there have been theologians that have been working on that for centuries, millennium. And, you know, they still, you know, are certain. I mean, that is a huge mystery, right? And that doesn't mean we don't do that. That's part of theology, and I'll come back to that. But I think the question that really grips all of us that we deal with, and it was a question that they asked Jesus, you know, who are you? And Moses asked, you know, ask God, who are you? It's the foundation of our real being. And that is the asking the question, who am I? And if you figure that out in the process, I think you discover who God is, and you begin that journey. So you begin saying, who am I? Well, for most of us, we've kind of bought into these lies. And the lies are, I am what I do. I am what I have and know. I am what others think or say about me. Now, when you look at every one of those, every one of those is going to change. Sometime in your life, you're going to increase in your knowledge. You're going to change jobs. You're going to, if people's opinions of you are going to go from good to bad or bad to, you know, good. That's just the nature of reality. That's not. And so, yes, at the very core of my being, when all of that is stripped away, who am I? When am I by myself and I can't, there's no plaques on the wall that I'm going to learn to, who am I at the very core of my being? And when you begin to wrestle with that, then that gets you into the whole idea of spiritual formation. How do I connect with God? Who am I? And that's really a huge part of the journey, I think. And, you know, when I went into retirement, I really struggled with that. You know, I was no longer the president of a seminary. People stopped calling me. I had all this, I'm still growing and learning. And what I thought as a 20-year-old, I sure don't think now as a 70-year-old. So all of that began to really, I began to wrestle anew with the holiday. Who am I now? Who am I? What is in my inner being? And I think that's the core of what it means to be spiritually formed, is to wrestle with that very being.
I love that. When you said that last week, I've been thinking about it since. I actually mentioned it teaching Sunday in a church here in Texas, and it made me think of I think it's Zinzendorf quote, where he says, preach the gospel, die and be forgotten. And I just have been the last year, having transitioned out of a ministry in New Mexico, have really had nothing going. I mean, I've had something going, but I mean, God transitioned us in a way to where we went from full on high octane pace of ministry to not doing much of anything. And I think the Lord has been saying to me what you just said, who am I without all this stuff? And it's been good for me. It's been hard for me. Oh my gosh, because it revealed my addiction to ministry, my addiction to self. It is a great little corridor to go down. Very difficult. But I think of all the pastors who've fallen by the wayside after they retire. Same thing used to happen in the military. The military guys would retire and they would get out and they would have nothing. And fishing would not fill the gap.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think their whole identity was in military service. It's something to be explored for the betterment of us as Christians, as God's people, for sure.
Yeah, and like you said, you've been through that. So, you know, who am I when I'm no longer a pastor, when I'm no longer a writer or a professor or a productive citizen? You know, who am I when my mind is gone through dementia? You know, am I still Daryl? Am I still Alan? You know, what is at the very core of my being? When you have nothing and no possessions and, you know, you're kicked in with all of this illness, who am I? Is a huge, huge question that I think I don't think the church has helped people to really address that. You know, even when you say, well, you're a child of God, well, there's a possession. You know, that's something you've attained. You know, that's, your identity is built on otherness, so that I'm different from everybody else because I'm a child of God. So you've setting your own ego up, even with that, to being, okay, at the core of my being, then what does that even mean, right?
Right. Yeah, I like that. You know, I've stopped hanging degrees on the wall. I don't have a very big library anymore. It's just funny how things transition. And I think ladder climbing, and I never was a ladder climber. I don't think any of that crowd would have messed with me, except you did. But I do have to admit that I get off on the next thing.
Yeah.
So like the next degree, the next church, the next huge thing that I can put on my resume that says I'm a success. And I'm like, where's that going to end? It ends with, it's not good if I'm not ready. If I don't know who I really am as a person. It's been life-giving to me in the pain of having to admit so I've gotten some things wrong. It's a great, great pursuit. And, you know, if you're listening today and this is connecting with you, I would encourage anybody younger to really start younger and realize you're not all these things that you do or think or feel. It's deeper than that. And I encourage you to figure that out early so that you can be steady and not get lost along the way. Daryl, we were also talking about this idea of oneness. You started kind of teaching when we were talking. I loved it. You were talking about oneness in John 17. Could you speak to that again? And as far as the relationship with God and all of that, could you just put that on the podcast for me?
Well, I'd be glad to. And it is one that's been profound, because when I begin to say at the core of my being, who am I? Well, I am one with God. That was the prayer that Jesus had. He says, I'm one with the Father, and my prayer for you is to be one with one another and one with us. So there is this connectedness. And, you know, we talk about theology of knowing God, but in a Western culture, that translates for many into knowing about God. You know, theology, that word know can be about facts, but in an Eastern culture, knowing is an intimacy. It's, I know my wife, I knew my wife meant there was a intimate relationship there. And so I can know about God, but that doesn't necessarily mean I have a real close connection with God. So this oneness was what that meant, to know God. It's to be connected with Him at the core of my being. He is my creator. I am connected with Him. That's my true self. And so that's the whole idea of what is their goal of discipleship. For me, my goal, the destination is to be one with God. That's the journey. The destination is to be one with Him.
What about this crazy narrative that you talked about?
So, you know, Bill Bright talked about the self being on the throne or versus Christ being on the throne. And there's a lot of ways of looking at that reality for all of us. But for me, it's this ego creates a manufactured self. We come back to those lies that we tell ourselves. And so we build this manufactured self. I am what I possess, I am what I know, I am what I do, I am what I have, I am what others think I am. And it's not reality, it's something we've manufactured. It's the false self. Paul refers to it as the flesh. Okay, it's something that's unreal in one sense, and it's going to be always changing. So the reality, and we create our own narratives, right? And so we have this crazy person living in our being, the crazy roommate that tells us all kinds of stuff built on fear, what's going to happen, what's not going to happen, or I'm better than I really am. But, you know, it's the ego that's always feeding to defend itself, that false self, that small self. And yet at our core of our being, the true self, the one in which we're one with God, is so opposed to those other things. I mean, it's contrary, it's different than those things. And so that oneness of being able to recognize this crazy roommate that's creating all this drama is not where I need to be. I'm creating that suffering. I'm creating that false image. I'm creating my own false narrative. And I have to come back. What is the narrative? What does that look like when I'm truly one with God?
That works. I love that. Daryl, you've seen a lot of action in the church. You're in the third and fourth quarter, like me, in our lives. What concerns you about the church today to the point that it's a burden in your soul?
Oh, great question. I may be in the 2-minute drill. You know, it is, I just feel for pastors today. It is a tough, tough role that they're playing. And I part of it is cultural and expectations of our members of that we try to serve. It's just, and with pandemic made things, I think, really pointed out our failure in discipleship. And it made things much more difficult to be that. So I have a real concern there. And I think, you know, what's that going to look like? And if I had to boil it down at the back to my core of my being, if God said the number one commandment was to love God and love your neighbor, you know, right? If the core of my being is love, if that's who God is, that's what I'm destined to be, is to be loved. Then I think the big thing is, how do I love my people? In the midst of all of the stuff going on, how do I love my people? Not what I teach them. That will be part of it, that will communicate my love. But how do I love people through all of the stuff that they have on their plates? You know, back in the 60s, when I was cutting my teeth on ministry, people would give you 5 hours a week. You know, they were there Sunday morning for 2 hours plus. They were there on Sunday night. Your leadership at least was on Wednesday night. Your kids and your families were. The church has played a more prominent role in culture than it is today, and so we're not going to recapture that. We're not going to go back to the 1950s. With all of the challenges facing families economically and so forth, I just don't see that happening. So then it begins to play, how do we do discipleship, and how do we make that happen? And how do I do that? And I think one of those things is being among your people, you know? And I think now that the pandemic is over, or at least squashed down a little bit, and we'll face another one maybe, but I think, how do I really get out among my people and live with them like Jesus did? I'm a large church, I can't do, you know, that with 3,000 people, but I can do it with some. And figuring out who that God has directed me toward to do that, and really demonstrate before my people how to love others.
What advice would you give to pastors and leaders concerning ministry today? Just right off the top of your head, you're going, okay, here's advice I'd give you, on top of what you said already, maybe.
Oh, boy. Invest in small groups. Invest in people. Make that your priority. Spend less time preparing for sermons and spend more time with your people. I had a friend who's a very good communicator who used to spend, you know, 20 hours a week plus maybe on a sermon. He cut it down to about 2 hours a week and spent more time with people. He said the quality of my sermons really didn't change, he felt like. And it really made his study a lot more focused. And he was able to work on the overflow and really concentrating on that. And I think the other thing is to model for people in our congregations what it means to be one with the Father. How does that change in terms of my own being? How am I modeling out what it means to be connected with Him? And how does that impact my behavior in the world?
Well, a couple things, and I'll let you go. At Southwestern, when you were there, I overheard you guys in chapel one day talking about this small group. And I remember I was like, hey, can I come? I wasn't even invited. I love that. And I got to get in that group. And you took about 12 of us guys. It may have been 10 or 12. And for about 7 years, we met on and off up in the faculty lounge, and you discipled us in a bunch of different ways. I think you pushed us into some spiritual practices that I'm not sure most of us would have walked into, to be honest. And I was going to ask you, why did you do that? But we've just answered why you did that from all we've just talked about, because you cared about small groups. And really, you kept that seminary so fresh. I always talk about that group as the best class I ever took in seminary that I didn't sign up for. Well, I signed up for it, but I forced my way in. And that group, really, that whole experience has stuck with me. It's been almost 20 plus years that we were in that faculty lounge all those days. Tell us the Rockbridge story before we leave. We got to do that. Now I'm going to put a link to the Rockbridge Seminary in the show notes, but tell us the story.
Well, in a lot of ways, it was really born out of a real need. And I began imagining what seminary could be like in the 21st century, knowing that online is going to have to be part of it. Everywhere we ran into people when I was at another institution, they could say, I'd love to go to seminary, but I don't want to leave my ministry. And so Rockbridge was really born out of how do we help those who are in ministry in a church and getting the training that they desire without leaving that. And so the online community really made that possible, which we couldn't have done it, many years ago when I first started. So that's kind of where we began. And then we began saying, how are we going to do spiritual formations online? And what we discovered is that I got to know my students far better online than I did in a class, because, we were communicating nearly every day as you do online through email and questions and all the wonderful communication tools. So I felt like I knew my students far better through the online experience than I did. And it was just you come and sit for an hour and they take notes and they do a test and they leave. And we had some opportunity, which is one of the reasons why we developed that small group. And I simply asked for, that day, God laid it on my heart. And I said, okay, by the end of the day, I want five people to come and say, not me inviting them, but people saying. And so I hadn't finished a class and a student said, could you meet with me? And so that was number one, right? And by the end of chapel, we had number five. So, and I never had to invite anyone to it.
No kidding. I never knew that part of the story.
So that's kind of how that, and the interesting thing about that, Alan, is that we had several that stayed in the area that kept coming to that small group even after they graduated. So
yeah,
it was a powerful thing in my life as well. I learned as much, and hopefully more than those that were part of that group. So in Rockbridge, we just tried to say, how can we do that better? And so we've rolled the spiritual disciplines and practices and spiritual formation to do it as a group, because God can form us without, when we're by ourselves. But I think there's something powerful when we're going through spiritual disciplines and you trying things that don't necessarily fit your spiritual pathway, but you learn and you hear other people reflect on it and what they're discovering about God. There's something wonderful about that practice that we need to incorporate, whether it's residential or online.
Is it true that Rockbridge was like the first fully online seminary?
We were one of the first. We were one of the first, certainly, to be accredited and fully online, because at that time, the Association of Theological Schools would not allow fully online programs. So we had to step outside of that network in order to have a fully online program. So yeah, we were one of the first that was accredited and fully online. There are many, many.
When I think of it, I know I remember Liberty had everything. They were like so broad. I don't know of another school I would have named back then that was addressing it the way Rockbridge was. Would that be a fair statement?
I'd hope so. Yeah, I hope so. We,
especially with the purpose-driven model, I guess also.
With the purpose-driven model, and with, we made a real big deal that the best way you learn ministry is being in ministry. And so we kind of had as our vetting process is that you come to Rockbridge because you are in ministry, and it may be paid, it may be unpaid, but for you to recognize ministry is not something I do when I get through with seminary. It's something I am right now doing, and I'm just receiving better training and support to help me in that journey. That's huge. And so, you know, most of our projects, we tried to ask ourselves, okay, is this going to stick in some file that you never use again, or maybe not even read? Or is this going to be a project that you can apply next week? And one of the gratifying things with students is when I travel is to ask them, so how are you using your seminary? And they just laugh at me and say, you remember that project we did for your class? Yeah, we just instituted that last week.
That's great.
Yeah. So the whole idea of really, you know, we say a lot about practice is where you really learn, but trying to make that, operationalize that in terms of a seminary's curriculum is not as easy as some people think. You have to have that kind of a venue to make it happen. You have to have people that are in ministry, doing ministry, and wanting to grow and improve.
That's dynamite. Well, if you're listening and you're maybe interested in getting equipped, you can click on the Rockbridge Seminary link down in the show notes. I'm also going to put an article from Dallas Willard about spiritual formation that's worth your time to keep the conversation going. Thank you, Daryl, for coming on today. We're out of time, but we're going to keep the conversation going for sure with everybody because it's a great cause that we have to be on mission with God with the days and time that we have. We encourage you guys as our listeners to stoke up the gift of God that is in you. Let God do that inside work first so that you'll know it's Him doing the outside work through you, I like to say. So take care, everybody. We will see you on the next podcast. And again, Daryl, thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Alan.
All right, man. God bless everybody.